I first would like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity, and also for everyone here for showing up, because, you know, I know that I myself have not been able to show up at 10 a.m. every day. So, and for today's talk, I'll be talking about, yeah, the get here means like obtain. So it's because I'll be talking about how we can obtain Majorana fermion, and it will consist of two parts. First of all, I'll talk about how to construct an electronic system that would contain Majorana fermions, and I'll explain how we can get them from half metal. And then I'll explain how we can detect Majorana fermions in helium-3b. So these two works have been done in collaboration with people at Stanford, Xu Cheng and Xiao Liang here, along with my fellow postdoc, Haijun, but we would also like to acknowledge very helpful discussion with people outside Stanford, Hongmin Wang, especially Hongmin Wang and Richard Martin for the first part of my talk, and also to Kimotoshi Kono, Bill Halperin, and Mike Stone for the second part of the work, the second part of the talk. So, I'm very sure that most people are quite familiar with all these concepts of Majorana fermion and topological superconductor, but just to give an introduction, I will just go over them again. So this, I mean, the concept of Majorana fermion actually, I mean, it has been explained very well in many review articles, including one written by Marcel. But I mean, it's very clear from the title of Ettore Majorana's original paper. I mean, he wants to treat. I mean, I know no Italian, absolutely no Italian at all, but I can still tell that it's something that's treating positron and electron in a symmetrical way. So just from that title, you know, I can kind of guess that this is a theory where, yeah, anyone can guess that this is theory about some fermion that's identical to its own antiparticle. And that tells us the most important part of the Majorana fermion, that it has only half the degrees of freedom as complex fermions like the electrons. So, but the situation here is complicated in some sense, because, I mean, this is a theory that he originally proposed to explain neutrino, but so far there has been no really like a conclusive proof about whether or whether or not this neutrino is a Majorana fermion. So it will be really interesting if we can be able to, if we are able to find this kind of Majorana fermion in condensed matter system. And the condensed matter system that we are especially looking into is this topological superconductor. And this concept of topological superconductor is actually a statement about its quasi-particle spectrum. So it refers to superconductor whose bulk quasi-particle spectrum is completely gapped, but you have a branch of gapless quasi-particles running along its boundary, and which is topologically protected. So in many sense, this is a superconductor that's a lot like the topological insulator, but it emphatically does not include a conventional S-wave superconductor where you don't really have any kind of sub-gap excitation without defect. And it also excludes Couperet superconductor because there are these nodal quasi-particles in the bulk. And so, but interestingly, if we look at the history, it's topological superconductor which comes first. I mean, this is something people realize only in retrospect, but I mean, just compare the dates. One is from 1972. Helium-3b is from 1972, and this bismuth selenide, I mean, that's just a couple of years ago. But still, the Majorana fermion part, I mean, the part we are most interested in is how Majorana fermions would come out in topological superconductor, and this becomes very obvious when we think about the how we obtain the spectrum in quasi-particle spectrum in superconductor. there's always this particle hole redundancy when we try to calculate the spectrum from Bogolyubov-Kajan Hamiltonian. And because of that, what that means is that the negative energy eigenstate we obtain in superconductor is not physical. So effectively, what that means is in term when it comes to these kind of boundary state is that let us compare like the integer quantum Hall system with its superconducting analog, which is P plus IP superconductor. Here, for integer quantum Hall state, these positive energy state and the negative energy eigenstate are all physical, but for the P plus IP superconductor, only the positive energy eigenstate is real. So what this implies is that we have only half the degrees of freedom in the edge state of P plus IP superconductor when we compare it with the edge state of the integer quantum Hall system. So if, I mean, at the zeroth level, we can understand the edge state of integer quantum Hall state as consisting of free electrons, then the edge state of P plus IP superconductor, we can regard it as consisting of something that only has half the degrees of freedom as the free electrons. And that's one of the basic reasons why we can think about this edge state that's consisting of Mironov fermions. This is all very interesting and nice, but I think the situation we are having right now is that, you know, we don't have any cases of any electronic system, yeah, which is confirmed to be like an intrinsic topological superconductor. For instance, I mean, helium-3b has been known for a very long time, but this is charge neutral. Of course, this is a charge neutral system. And people have been talking a lot about strontium ruthenate, but if you really look at the data objectively, we do not really have an evidence that it has a gapped quasi-particle excitation. Its bulk quasi-particles are completely gapped, and nobody has seen the edge state either. So this has given rise to many, many different proposals for actually building, kind of like building up some equivalent of spinless P plus IP superconductor. And I mean, this, I'm sure that's not, this listing may look long, but it's, I'm absolutely certain that it's, I mean, by no means, this is not really comprehensive at all. But I mean, one thing you can say is that in many of the cases that these papers deal with, these proposals for building actually this kind of P plus IP superconductor, of course, often you obtain it from superconducting proximity effect. That's a common ingredient in all of these proposals. But in many of these proposals actually contain another ingredient, that is, I mean, they have been aiming to obtain spinless P plus IP superconductivity that comes from just a single band. And in order to do so, what they often do is, first of all, they have some spin over coupling in their system. Then they open up a gap between two. They open up an energy gap, and then they try to insert Fermi energy somewhere inside this gap. So it really, many of these proposals actually involve fine-tuning of Fermi level. And, you know, obtaining both superconducting proximity effect and fine-tuning of Fermi level may prove to be tricky, because essentially just by being in proximity to superconductor, you are introducing some uncertainty to the Fermi level. Of course, I mean, many of these proposals do involve system, kind of like a semiconductor system that people have been long working familiar with, so this may end up working out, but it'll still be worth trying to find some candidate material where this kind of Fermi energy fine-tuning is not necessarily at all. and along with other conditions like having good contact with superconductor and being two-dimensional. So that is why we have decided to look at half metal. So half metal is conceptually it's very straightforward. It just means that it's like having a system which is a metal for spin up and which is an insulator for spin down. And there's actually one very well known example, like chromium dioxide, the material that we use for cassette tape. I know that by next generation cassette tape would not be something people know about, but I mean at least everyone in this room knows of what that is. In addition, there's like nickel, manganese, antimony, and calcium dope, lanthanum manganate. And so essentially, we're just given the Fermi surface that has no spin degeneracy in each kind of material. And in fact, the interesting thing is that the gap for the minority spin is often very large. It's almost within the order of magnitude of the bandwidth itself. So there's absolutely no question, no need to have any kind of concern about the fine-tuning Fermi level with these material. So now we have decided on our target material. So how are we going to achieve the superconducting proximity effect? So the kind of model we have for this is that we have a two-dimensional half metal in proximity to S-wave superconductor. So we are not making use of any kind of unconventional superconductor here. All we need is a very conventional S-wave superconductor. And the kind of situation we want is that we want an absolutely clean interface. So it should be clean enough that the momentum parallel to the plane would be a good quantum number. And we seek to describe the proximity effect by having this picture of that these two systems are just coupled by interface hopping. And when we do that, I mean, one thing immediately comes out that this can only be, old parity pairing. And one reason why this happens is that essentially we're pairing up the like electrons and half metal. That's pairing up like spin. So essentially we can only have like an odd parity pairing. And the other important thing is that this odd parity pairing can never really take place unless we allow for spin flip hopping. So essentially it's like we have the way these half metal electrons would pair up through this kind of proximity effect is that a pair of half metal electrons should hop over to S-wave superconductor in such a way that only one of them flips its spin. And what that also implies is that the symmetry of the pairing correlation that comes out here would be really determined by this momentum-dependent hopping. So it's like essentially saying that it's the hop interface hopping that determines symmetry of the pairing we are going to get here. So now I need to explain how this is going to give us P plus IP pairing. And to understand this, we need to realize that because we are having this interface in our system, we are breaking inversion symmetry. So at the interface, we are always going to have some kind of Rajpot-spin orbit coupling. And the question is, how is this Rajpot-spin orbit, how are we going to have interface hopping that has the same symmetry as the Rajpot-spin orbit coupling? And the answer is, if we take this case where the half metal spin polarization is perpendicular to the interface, we can get, the spin flip hopping that's analogous to Rajpa spin orbit coupling would actually have this kind of chiral dependence on the in-plane momentum. And you can actually construct a very simple lattice model to realize this. Suppose that we have same, we have both scalar lattice for both half metal and the superconductor, and they have the exact lattice matching. Well, the simplest and the most dominant spin-conserving hopping will be just a direct hopping from the half metal, between half metal and the superconductor. And the most dominant spin-flip hopping that is of odd parity in momentum would be kind of like this odd, this odd parity nearest neighbor hopping. So if that has the right, like a P plus IP symmetry, we can say, I mean, that would give us some analog of Rajpa spin over coupling. And you might wonder, I mean, if we should always have this kind of chirality, because this is not the only way to get odd parity nearest neighbor hopping. But the answer is, if we want to cancel out this kind of spin flip hopping, the only way we can do that is to have some spin flip hopping equivalent of Dresselhaus spin orbit coupling. And this Dresselhaus spin orbit coupling should be of exactly the same strength as this Rajpa spin orbit coupling. So in general, if we are going to have this kind of spin orbit coupling effect from the interface hopping, it is going to have some it is going to have this kind of chirality. And so it's very clear that once we put in these kind of interface hopping, this is going to give us P plus IP pairing. And from this picture, we actually obtain another interesting conclusion that if there's like a ferromagnetic domain in half metal, then once we induce superconductivity, that is actually going to give us domain boundary between P plus IP pairing and P minus IP pairing. So we have taken care of the superconductivity part of this half metal proposal, but this is not the end of the story. We need to think, actually, we need to think a little bit more about the band structure of the half metal.
So, but I agree that the P plus IP pairing, but TC will be zero unless you have rather large coupling. Rather large spin orbit coupling.
Oh yes, we can. I can show. Toward the end, I can certainly. Yeah, we do know a candidate material which is going to give us considerable spin orbit coupling. I can.
But I mean, this is the important question. Have you done have you or anybody else done in real calculation to show that spin orbit coupling will be large enough to actually give you a TC for the P plus IP superconductor? That's not micro Kelvin or something like that.
Oh, in this case, mm-hmm. in the case of this sodium cobalt that I'm going to talk about, mm-hmm. the spin orbit coupling is sufficient to give you 10% spin canting. I'll talk about this a little bit more later. So I first need to, before we go into the candidate material, I need to tell you a little bit about the band structure requirement. So what do I mean by band structure requirement? Well, what this is coming from is the fact that just having P plus IP superconductor may not actually give you topological superconductor. And we can think about a very simple example. Let us consider a two-band system of a spinless electron with electron pocket around the gamma point and hole pocket around the end point. And let's say that we have induced P plus IP superconductivity on both bands. But in that case, it's like the P plus IP superconductivity of the hole pocket is effectively equivalent to P minus IP pairing of the electrons. And once that comes out, effectively we have two pockets with opposite chirality, so interband scattering can destroy any kind of edge we might have from this kind of system. So we really want to have a single pocket, single Fermi surface for our half metal, and this cannot actually happen if we just have half metal in isolation, actually, because, you know, when we talk about Ruttinger's theorem, we just usually say that if you want to have a single Fermi pocket, we need to have odd number of electrons per unit cell. But if you want to apply this kind of Ruttinger's theorem to the spin polarized system, the actual conclusion is that you need to have fractional number of electrons per unit cell if you want to have single Fermi surface. Now, this would not be possible when we have this kind of system in isolation. The only way we can achieve this is that if we have a half metallic system that's like a surface of some bulk insulator, there may be some charge transfer mechanism between the surface and the bulk in such a way that you will actually end up with fractional number of electrons per unit cell at for the surface half metal. So essentially, what we are trying to find actually is some kind of like a surface half, trying to find some kind of a surface half metal. And then we will be able to achieve this single Fermi pocket without applying any kind of gating. And so here's the system we had in our original paper. There we thought about constructing a heterostructure where the bulk is just a zinc telluride, which is a very well-known insulator, and we lay two layers of vanadium telluride on top of it. And what we found is that vanadium telluride in bulk is a half metal, and what we found is that when we have this kind of heterostructure, because there's a charge transfer from between this bulk zinc telluride and the surface vanadium telluride, we are actually going to get 1/2 electrons per unit cell for vanadium telluride. And this is actually going to give us single Fermi pocket. And the very nice thing about this result is that this single Fermi pocket is going to be maintained even when we change the Fermi level by as much as like 300 millielectron volts. So this proposal at least is quite free from any need to do any kind of like a Fermi level fine tuning. But we have to admit that, you know, this is a rather complicated thing to do because, you know, we have to actually, the candidate material itself is actually obtained from this kind of constructing heterostructure. But after finishing this work, I mean, some of my collaborators were also involved in this band structure calculation for sodium cobaltate. And there was a very interesting result came out. So this is certainly a stoichiometric material, but when you terminate when you have the surface terminating with the cobalt dioxide, what they found is that the surface is going to become half metallic, even though this bulk is a very good insulator with insulating gap of 1 electron volt.
Is this experimental finding, or is it?
No, this is a band calculation, and right now we are doing, Yulin Chen is doing photoemission experiment to confirm this property. But at least, you know, this is a very, at least on level of band structure calculation, this is a very robust result. So, and this has lots of nice properties. I mean, it's true that, you know, it does depend a lot on the surface condition, because if the terminating layer is sodium atoms rather than the cobalt dioxide, this is not going to give us half metal. Actually, it's going to give us just a plain insulating surface. However, once yeah, once you get a very clean cobalt dioxide surface, you know, you have this half metal with just a single 3D surface. And what you also had is that this, yeah, these cobalt, the magnetic property of this material is such that the net magnetization is actually zero. So how they achieve half metallicity is because, you know, there's a spin polarization coming from the cobalt atoms on a single layer. But whereas they have a intra-layer ferromagnetism, between layers they actually have anti-ferromagnetism. So you are not really going to be worried about any kind of like a large magnetic field coming out from the half metal.
So this is very nice, and I hope it works out. But this sort of band structure often doesn't lead to the realistic material, because any impurities on the surface could pin the Fermi level, magnetism could be destroyed, and one really needs experiments. But I think this could motivate experiments, and you know, this is a good motivation. But you know, surface physics is very tricky.
Yes, and it's, yeah, I mean, I fully admit that this, our proposal relies a lot on having very clean surface, achieving very clean surface and very clean interface.
Which usually takes many years of work by many people. That's why, you know, semiconductors, it took 50 years for surfaces to be clean enough to avoid impurity-induced surface states and other things.
Well, I mean, that's true, and you know, often there are advantages in going with materials we know well, but you know, this is a new field. We do not know what difficulties will arise, so it's always nice to have many different ways of trying out things. So far we have talked about how to construct some system that would contain myron or fermion. But to be honest, I mean, actually, we know that there is this one system where long-established theories actually should give us myron and fermion. And the theory for this system has been established for a very, very long time. And that's the B phase of helium-3 superfluid.
Sorry, I didn't get the crust of the proposal. So you take this half metal and you put it on top of superconductor? What's the idea? I mean,
no, so you take this sodium cobaltate with a very clean surface, and then you put a superconductor on top of it, and there should be proximity effect between the surface of this material and the superconductor. That should give us P plus IP superconductor.
How clean is this material? What's the mean free path? It's a metal, so what's the mean free path?
I mean, what Roman is getting at, which is what I was going to ask you at the end, that this is a P plus IP superconductor.
Yes.
Any disorder will destroy it.
Yes.
Because the disorder is very weak. In a metal, how do you control disorder? In a metal, disorder is small only on the scale of Fermi energy, not on the scale of 1 Kelvin. So you somehow need to induce a 500 Kelvin proximity effect superconductivity, because I do not know how clean this material is, but it's not going to be much cleaner than semiconductors. So you'll have scattering, which is usually going to be, you know, several Kelvins, even if the material is very impure by material science standard, then delta tau is not going to be larger than one, which is what you need. This is the problem with metals, that the moment you have non-SOF superconductivity and you do not have this so-called Anderson's theorem, basically Abrikos of Gorkov argument doesn't work. And this would be, you know, serious issue in any proposal involving metals.
And yeah, all I can say is that the, you know, in addition to any kind of like a mean free path, I don't have mean free path off top of my head, but I mean, one other issue we need to worry about is that the surface of this material should be absolutely sodium free for our proposal. I mean, at least it should not contain enough sodium to, you know, If the in-plane momentum is not well-defined, this proposal is hard, it's difficult to make it work.
Yeah, so my question was basically, as Shankar was mentioning, that even if you assume that the topological phase will appear only if tau, which is the disorder scattering time, and delta are much larger than one. So in other words, the effective gaps that you're inducing in your topological superconductivity has to be much larger than the momentum relaxation rate that you get. And it's very, very difficult to do in metals where entry passes, you know,
I would say
10
possible.
Centimeters.
I mean, how do you do that in metals? I mean, metals are filled with defects. I mean, metal momentum relaxation is weak only on the scale of Fermi energy, which is 10,000 Kelvin. So it's not weak on the scale of Fu Kelvin. And your P plus IP gap is going to be of the order of Fu Kelvin. I mean, unless this material somehow is known to have, I mean, I know nothing about this material. Maybe it's known that the mean free path is, you know, many, many microns. If that's the case, you're fine. But short of that.
Well, I think, yeah. And another thing I should say is that I cannot really give you absolute answer for this question because a lot will depend on, you know, what kind of superconductor you're going to put on top of it.
No, disorder in the superconductor doesn't matter. We are talking about disorder in the material, you have the P plus IP superconductor.
I just mean that, you know.
TC.
Well, we are going to compare it to TC, and a lot of TC, determining TC, that depends a lot on what kind of superconductor we're going to.
Correct, but it's going to be of the order of Kelvin. It's not going to be the order of 1000 Kelvin, right? I mean, that we know. So.
I thought there are some difference between just the Kibarazaki with disorder and this kind of S-low supernatural with disorder.
Yeah, these are differences, of course. Roman, I have studied extensively over the last 1 year. That's why you're asking this question. This is, but the bottom line is that what we are saying, if delta is the superconducting gap and tau is the momentum relaxation time, delta tau has to be larger than one. There is no escape from that. You know, you could get like, you know, that one could be 1.3 or, you know, could be even pi. For a very simple reason. Every momentum relaxation scattering is going to affect the P plus IP gap because the thing that is known as Anderson's theorem does not apply.
Well, but we had a very clean system in case of strontium ruthenate, so yeah, I certainly agree that this kind of material would need some logic work on the sample control, quality control. And this, yeah. So, yeah. So aside from this, trying to construct electronic system which should contain Bionic fermions, we can also go back to the system which is known to have, which we all expect to have Bionic fermions, but we have not detected. And that would be helium-3b. And actually, one amusing thing about here is that, you know, lots of property in helium-3b can be explained by the fact that from this peculiar nature of the pairing it has. And the most interesting property here is that even though this is a p-wave superconductor, the gap magnitude is isotropic around the Fermi surface. And that comes about, the easiest way to understand this is why this is so is because essentially you have J equals zero pairing. The total angular momentum is zero for this pairing. So this already implies that somehow, whereas in the normal state you have the separate rotational symmetry for both spin, oh, this should have an S. Both spin and orbital angular momentum, when you enter below TC, actually only symmetry remaining is the total angular momentum, and somehow the relative rotation between spin and orbital angular momentum is broken. And exactly the way it happens is that it's because of this J equals zero pairing, and when you look at how this J equals zero pairing should come out, just from this kind of angular momentum addition we all learned in undergraduate, a very interesting thing emerges. When you put this in this kind of matrix for the pairing gap, we find that its momentum dependence is exactly same as the spin orbit coupling we would have in this 3D topological insulator. And because of this, the interesting thing is that when we look at the first quantized Hamiltonian, actually the 3D topological insulator and helium 3B comes out exactly the same. The only thing that's different between these two Hamiltonian is the basis. Obviously, this topological insulator involves like two orbital, whereas this helium 3B is just a single band system. So we can clearly see that helium 3B should have only half the degree of freedom as the bismuth selenide. So one big thing that we should find, and this is directly related to what we mean by finding the Majorana nature of the surface state, is that, you know, how are we going to show that the surface state of helium 3B has only half the degrees of freedom as the surface state of bismuth selenide? That's the main question with the helium 3B. And another question that's related question is that, you know, we talk about this effective surface Hamiltonian for bismuth selenide, and that should certainly apply to helium 3B, but, you know, does the spin in this Hamiltonian mean the same thing in helium 3B as in bismuth selenide? And we can get the answer for these questions just by doing mode expansion for this Hamiltonian. So we are pretty familiar with how the mode expansion comes out in bismuth selenide. But when we apply this to helium 3B surface state, something changes. Here we have like both the conduction band and the valence band. But there's no such thing as negative energy eigenstate for helium 3B. This negative energy eigenstate is just a redundancy in helium 3B. So what happens is that instead of having an annihilation operator for valence band, that turns into creation operator for this quasi-particle excitation. So basically, if you maintain your spin state, it's like creating negative energy eigenstate is just same as annihilating positive energy eigenstate. So the way we should picture this is that basically, if you have a momentum, if you have a surface state with momentum in plus x direction and for helium 3B surface state, you essentially have a surface state that's like that's like the equal superposition of electrons with spin polarization in plus y direction and the hole with spin polarization hole with spin polarization in the same plus y direction. So basically, these momentum eigenstates are not particle number or spin eigenstates. And
let me just make a remark here. These are eigenstates. They say it's not spin eigenstate, but physically, it has a well-defined moment because creating electron at a state with spin up is equal. That moment you get is the same as annihilating a electron in spin down state. In both cases, you have a moment which is up.
No, that's if you're. If we take the spin quantization to be in plane, I mean, basically we are talking about equal, you know, creating electrons and holes with the same spin polarization.
I
think your statement holds true if we take the spin quantization axis to be out of plane. But in my construction, we are actually taking.
Probably you could call it a spin left electron and spin right hole.
Yeah.
I'm just making a general remark that this spin operator in this Baudouin-Dejean Hamiltonian, it's not the same as the physical spin. So C up dagger and C down really at the same moment to the system.
So the important point here, I think the what we should really take from Liang's remark is the fact that, you know, this, how you take the spin quantization axis is very important. So what actually comes out from this mode expansion is that once you take the spin quantization axis to be in plane, and we confine ourselves to sub-gap excitation, there is no distinction between creation and annihilation operator for the, from the surface state. But this is a very interesting implication. So the surface, what this means is that the surface excitation is not going to lead to any kind of fluctuation in particle number density. It also cannot lead to any fluctuation in the any kind of in-plane component of the spin either, spin density either. However, it can lead to spin fluctuation out of plane. So basically, you know, in addition to being charge neutral, it makes the it kind of makes the spin density fluctuation to go in only one direction. And so when we say that we want to measure the viral nature of these, the surface state, this is what we really need to measure. And since we are trying to understand something that comes only from these low energy excitation, the quantity we should really go for is the imaginary part of the spin susceptibility, because basically it's like the only the chi imaginary part of chi zz would be non-zero, whereas the imaginary component of chi xx and chi yy would be just zero in this kind of system. So what we should go for is some kind of like a resonance spin spectroscopy. Yeah, okay. So what we are we'll try to do is that we are actually going to do that through some spin relaxation rate experiment. And the reason why we are taking, what's going to show up here is that we need to understand that here there's like a two direction that's built into the spin relaxation rate formula. One is coming from the spin flip matrix element, because a spin flip matrix element has a direction defined coming from the Zeeman field direction. And also this spin susceptibility also has direction coming from the surface state spin density fluctuation. And because of that, what's going to happen here is that obviously we are not going to get any spin relaxation if when the surface state spin fluctuation direction is aligned with the Zeeman field direction. That's not going to give us any kind of like a spin relaxation at all. So basically we are going to have here is that if we introduce some external spin into our helium-3b surface, and we try to measure the spin relaxation of this external spin, we will actually see that there will be no spin relaxation rate enhancement coming from the surface state at all if the Zeeman field is actually aligned with the surface normal. And there's a very nice way of doing that, because when we insert this external spin into helium-3 liquid, what happens is that it opens up this external spin gets trapped inside nano cavity, and we can control the depth of these nano cavity using DC electric field. So what happens is that when we have a Zeeman field aligned along surface normal, we are not going to get any surface, the spin relaxation rate is going to be independent of the depth of this bubble. But when we have this Zeeman field that's parallel to the surface, there is going to be this spin relaxation rate enhancement as we bring the a bubble closer and closer to the surface. Yes.
Okay, you finished. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and this, yeah, I'm done. This is my conclusion, and thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, so maybe you already said it, but I didn't get it. So I want to ask about the quantization axis of this thing. So am I right that the operator at gamma 1, gamma 2, where one, gamma 1 and gamma 2 are the Majorana mode at k equals 0 on the surface? So that has a spin moment, but the direction of that spin moment really depends on how you choose the d vector for the ground state of the superfluid helium in the bulk, right?
Yes, that's true.
Because the d vector really can have a SO3 rotation, right? I think
they call this n hat vector in helium theory literature. It's a little bit different from d vector, but yeah, you're basically right. If that vector actually is tilted with respect to the surface state. The spin density fluctuation direction should actually follow the n hat vector and not the surface.
So what really pins that direction?
Usually the surface can pin the direction, and also the magnetic field can also affect the direction. So actually, if you start to apply large enough in-plane magnetic field, it's actually going to get canted. This has been worked out in the 70s, actually.
Thanks.
Okay, so we've run over time, so thanks for coming.